Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell.
And good afternoon out there in Radio Land. It is time for the best political talk show you've never heard of. It is Backroom Politics here from Podcast Village in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Joining me in studio for the best political talk show you've never heard of, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. He is the one we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Good afternoon, Justin.
Yeah, and my 11 o'clock, he is the retired one-star admiral from your United States Navy, fresh from Boca del Vista. He is the one we know as Admiral Ken Carradine. Hello, Admiral Ken.
Good to be back in civilization, Justin.
And in a shocking, stunning turn of events, coming in from the Windy City, the Great White North, she is the longtime field producer for the Today Show here in Washington, D.C., media goddess. We know her as Laura Chavez. Hello, Laura.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome to the studio. We miss you.
Thanks. It is, it's been a lot of traveling
lately.
A lot of travel.
Yay. And Rob the Engineer keeping us honest behind the glass. We have got a lot to talk about. And believe it or not, nothing dealing with Mueller right now. So here's what we got. We're trying to figure out if there is an actual crisis on the southern border. If you listen to the Trump administration, the president seems to think that this is the biggest invasion since War of the Worlds. This is out of control. They're taking over the country. It is a full-fledged military onslaught. If you listen to others in Congress and others in America, they will tell you that, nah, it's not so bad. Now, the question is, what's reality? And Alan Moore, is this a case of either the president or the opposition are right, somewhere in the middle is the truth?
Well, in this case, the truth is not either of the positions you described. There is an emergency. It's a humanitarian emergency, not a security emergency. The numbers of people seeking refuge, seeking asylum, has spiked in March up to a level that may be may reach 100,000 during the month of March. Most of them are women and children, some fathers, and then a healthy dose of unaccompanied minors. That's usually going to be males. It's not the security threat that the president continues to try to describe or try to claim, because the security threats historically have come from younger men. That's not who's showing up now, who's filling up all the capacity on both sides of the border.
Well, hold on. To not defend the Trump administration, but the reality is that, you know, they talk about the big target that the president uses is the MS-13, the Latin Kings, the gangs that are coming across the border in large numbers. There are youth that come over that may not already be a part of gangs, but are prime targets for recruitment once they get across the border. I mean, does that lend some legitimacy to the Trump claim?
Well, how about those little babies in their mother's arms? They might be potential MS-13 recruits too. There's not a lot of evidence that I've seen that these younger kids who are coming, unaccompanied minors, are coming up because they are already gang members or might join.
Or they're prime recruits.
they're certainly recruitable, conceivably, depending upon where they go in America and who they live with. And it's not just the fact that you've got a 15-year-old who's coming into America. He may be living with a family in northern Minnesota or in Idaho. Chances are that such a kid is not going to be a highly recruitable MS-13 person. The problem now, and I'm not saying there aren't potential recruitables. I'm not saying there aren't some bad people. That's the reason we have a process of clearing folks, of investigating them. But right now, the right. whole capability of assessing the truth behind what people say is the system is overwhelmed. We right. don't have places to put people for a day or two or a week or two or five.
All right, Admiral Ken.
So, yeah, I think the other part of the answer to your question is this as much of a crisis as the administration contends, or as less of a crisis as the opposition to the administration contends, is that this is something of a crisis of Donald Trump's making. The spike, if you will, began when the president talked about pulling back funding to help tamp down violence in countries like Honduras.
Well, the president's talking about pulling all funding from Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador.
And again, I think part of what the president does not understand, that his transactional view of foreign policy does not hold water in this particular type of situation. So this is a mess of the Trump administration's making. They are pulling back funding for. Some of the they've cut the number of judges that are looking at asylum hearings. They are basically pushing women and children to live in less than humane conditions in some cases. So, yeah, this has become a big deal. Alan is absolutely right that there has been a spike. And what's unusual here is that the people coming across the border are not predominantly Mexicans looking for jobs anymore. They are people that are refugees. These are women and children. And, you know, one of the things that we like to say around my house is that a little bit of empathy goes a long way. You got to ask yourself, what would it take for a mom to basically take her children away from their home, walk in some cases 1,000 miles to get to a border and willing to hang out and hope that they can get in? Things have got to be pretty damn bad.
Okay, but at the same time, Laura Chavez, how far does the empathy have to go? I mean, at some point, does the president have a legitimate claim that says that, hey, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Honduras, if you want to play in the Western Hemisphere, you're going to have to clean up your own house? What's the incentive for them to clean up their own house if all they're going to do is just migrate north to the United States?
I think part of the incentive that was initially there that is now being withdrawn or being threatened to be withdrawn is the funding from the United States, that, hey, this money is meant to go to programs that will help boost your economy, help try to clean up crimes, help, you know, get more jobs out there. But with the United States withdrawing that money, all of a sudden you've created another problem, not only on the back end where admittedly, like there are illegal border crossings. I don't think anyone's arguing that, but asylum seeking is completely fair. But now you're creating a situation on the front end too, where you're creating, you know, by withdrawing this money, withdrawing the support of the United States, you're creating the melanin monster that Trump is so terrified of.
Okay, but if you look at it from the reverse, saying, look, we've given them that money. I mean, each of those countries receives hundreds of millions of dollars every year in federal aid from organizations like the U.S. Agency for International Development, the State Department, your Department of Commerce. And that money, which is supposed to go to programs to show economic benefit, drive economic expansion in those countries, end up in the pockets of a corrupt government. Well, you know, does the president have a legitimate gripe saying, why are we going to keep putting money in their pockets when we could use that for other things?
I totally understand what you're saying. And I think there is a certain validity to that point. But you are then at that point, when you're taking all of this away, you're also saying, you know what? We wash our hands. We don't know what to do with you. You're on your own. These aren't, you know, major countries. These are third world countries for the most part that don't necessarily have the infrastructure to sustain, you know, any sort of viable economy where they're able to lift people. They don't have 15,000 people. They don't have, you know, Amazon moving into their Crystal City neighborhoods to try and boost the economy. These are places that are going to need more work. They're going to need a lot more help. And in some of these places, they're ruled by a slightly less democratic government, is how I'll say it.
Right.
Which leads everyone to kind of understand that, like, the infrastructure in general might not be there just yet, but if you keep working with it, try to keep investing. This isn't like, here's $20, you know, everything's fixed. This is a long-term problem that needs to be addressed.
Right. Alan Moore.
Yeah, it's important to understand how foreign aid works in countries like Central America, which is typical of what happens around the world. We don't write a check to a corrupt government. We write checks to organizations that are typically nonprofit partners. Some of them are American companies with subsidiaries there who we contract with to do particular things, to develop to programs for children, for at-risk kids, for judicial reform. Does some money get siphoned off and find its way into the pockets of corrupt government? Are there bribes that have to be paid to get access to things, sometimes even to get a telephone? Yes. Can we fix – but I wanted to speak first to that, because this money is not – just suitcases of cash.
And I don't think anybody's saying that.
Well, that's what you were implying at the beginning.
No.
I think Alan hits an important. There are a lot of Trump supporters who think that's what's going on.
I agree with that.
I'm not saying you don't agree. I'm just saying the way you characterized is we send all this money down there and it ends up in the pockets of corrupt officials. Well,
it does, to an extent.
It does here, too.
That's true.
Like, let's be real.
Look, all I'm saying is that we don't just deliver suitcases full of cash to corrupt governments. Are there ways that government officials and local police and so on get their hand in? Absolutely there are. But usually with foreign aid, we're using third-party organizations, often with a U.S. affiliation. Some are companies you've never heard of, but some are organizations called Save the Children or Doctors Without Borders, or can be global.
Or even government agencies like Trade and Development Agency,
well,
like USTDA.
They tend though to give money for particular purposes through to different parties.
Like infrastructure projects that end up.
So again, we're using third parties. If we're going to build infrastructure, then we're going to use some big international construction company that's probably going to have to shell out a little bit of money to be able to function. But if they're going to build a port or a train station, some kind of warehousing facilities, all I'm saying is threatening to cut off aid is about as dumb a thing as we can do if our objective is...
Oh, no, there's a dumber thing.
To strengthen...
There's a dumber thing.
To strengthen the local capacity, improve the government, improve how government functions so that people won't be so desperate to leave, then we have to continue to invest down there. Maybe we have to put more controls. But we're not just blindly handing over money to these third parties either. There's an enormous amount of oversight that goes into this stuff. And
I'll let you go, but I want to come back to another issue, too. All right. Yeah. Go ahead, Admiral Ken.
I think, you know, this whole discussion in how I think some that are loyal followers of the administration look at this can best be described as that old, the less you know about a thing, the simpler it must be. I do know for a fact that there are a good number of the president's supporters who think that we are sending suitcases full of money to these foreign governments. And I think that shutting it down will have the act of creating a bigger demand signal in the U.S., I think, because as things go crazier in those places that they're fleeing and things look less crazy here, only the rational will go, and only the irrational will stay. And there appears to be a good number of rational people who are trying to flee tyranny and terrorism and crime and violence to try to go someplace where it's safe to raise their families.
Actually, Admiral Ken brings up a good point, Laura. It seems to me that the administration, even though they may have somewhat of a point, is doing what they do best. They oversimplify it to sell it to their base, and it makes it look like that they are the superheroes of national security and protecting American jobs. Whereas I think that if, you know, you ask somebody in, like, where you are from, Chicago, if they know what an organization like USAID does, USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or TDA, the Trade and Development Agency out of the U.S. government, if you were to ask them what those agencies do, they would have no clue. And yet, a lot of the foreign aid support that we give to some of these foreign countries, particularly in Latin America, come from those agencies. It almost seems like we're cutting our nose off to spite our face just to sell a point that is being oversimplified by the White House. Is that accurate?
I think that's accurate in a lot of ways. We live in a very much a headline-driven society right now. And to be perfectly honest, like, this is, I mean, we're inside the Beltway. We have a very, you know, in the dirt, in the mud, rolling around with the pigs. We know the ins and the outs of this. We're interested in it. A lot of people in this area's livelihood depend on it. But if you go out to places like West Virginia or South Bend, Indiana, or anywhere else where this isn't, you know, the topic of conversation at your local bar or, you know, at a shopping mall, or isn't something that's in your face, you do have to you don't have to simplify it, but learning all of this and knowing all of this is a commitment to the subject matter. And right. Bottom line, a lot of these people have more pressing things in their lives to worry about.
They're worried about their rent payments. Exactly. They're worried about making mortgage payments,
exactly.
Buying food,
exactly.
Their medication.
So to them, yes, USAID is a great organization. It does, you know, 1,000 different things, but they don't care about that. They don't have time to learn all of these different nonprofits. They don't have time to learn the difference between Child Help and St. Jude and Child Hunger. Like, they just know that, like, there's an organization out there doing something. Ideally, you know, the money's going to the right place. But bottom line, can I get food on the table? So we are in a very overly simplified world right now. And I think that does drive a lot of the conversation in that, you know, as much information that can be gleaned off of a Facebook headline, that's your new baseline.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, I want to build on what Laura is saying here. There's an enormous amount of ignorance in the country. We have a president who feeds the ignorance rather than tries to bring light in and do some education.
Well, let me
finish my thought here. So people don't understand what aid is even for. They have a horrendously an embarrassingly wrong notion of how much foreign aid we spend. It's actually around 1% of our total budget. But if you ask people, and polls historically have done this, they'll think it's 15 to 20%.
Right.
And it's not. And then when it gets to the question of what is that aid for, the notion is, well, it's supposedly just to help those people, but we need help at home. Here's an opportunity, and so we shouldn't be spending our scarce resources. The problem, the crisis at our border provides a fabulous opportunity for a president willing to learn and to teach, to explain why foreign assistance is a good thing. If we can create stability in those three countries that are providing most of the people now, it's not Mexico.
It's Honduras, El Salvador, Nicaragua.
And yes, if we could create a degree of stability and cause people to not want to risk their lives and flee to an uncertain future, here's the perfect opportunity to say, we're going to increase our investment there. We want people to stay there. We want them to be safe and have some opportunity for hope. Because if we don't spend the money there, they are going to come. We're going to have this disastrous growing problem on our border. And we want to interfere with that.
Here's a conundrum. is you talk about the ignorance of the general American public that does not understand what foreign aid does and the vital role it plays, not just in the humanitarian efforts, but in the role of even national security. Even.
It helps us.
It does help us. But is it a matter of, like Laura says, you know, the somebody in Omaha, Nebraska, who is, you know, thousands of miles away from the southern border, thousands of miles detached from these humanitarian encampments that are down now along the Mexican-U.S. border, are we asking too much for them to really give a crap about what's happening down there? Because, quite frankly, it doesn't affect their kids' education.
Sure it does.
How?
Sure it does.
How?
In the words of my late great dad, everything costs money. We can either spend the money in foreign aid, or we can spend the money and increase taxes to basically take care of the problem.
Hold on, let me finish. Losing me.
Everything costs money. So let's say we basically we create this barrier that Trump wants at the wall. Somebody's got to pay for that. We know Mexico's not going to pay for it because they ever gave us the big fat finger on that. Okay, so everything costs money. So we can either pay the money to stop the demand signal in El Salvador and Nicaragua, or we can basically, you know, pretend that it's one big issue and we pay increased taxes for border security, higher taxes for Customs and Border Patrol agents, higher taxes for everything that goes along with the infrastructure that would be required to basically keep these people out.
Okay, but Admiral Cat, let's just jump in, though. You're in Spokane, Washington,
yep.
Okay? If you're in Spokane, Washington—
And you're paying 50% income tax anyway, but go ahead.
Okay. We can go to Wyoming, North Dakota, anywhere.
Go ahead.
No. But the reality is if you are the average American, whether that money goes to Honduras or not does not directly affect your life on a daily basis. Whether that money sees daylight in San Salvador, El Salvador, capital.
I will give you that, but you know what?
Why does America have to care?
I'm trying to answer your question. So I'll give you on a daily basis, no, they probably won't. But when it comes time to basically pay that tax bill, which we're all going to do next week, yeah, at that point you're going to feel it. And people are feeling it now.
How?
Through increased taxes, Justin. Everything costs money.
Justin, you can't simply say to a given family in West Virginia, Eastern Washington, or whatever, here's how it's going to affect your daily life. But you can say, as we do constantly, and we look to leaders to help educate, here's what we're spending our money for. Here's why we're spending that money. You may not see it in your community this week, but we see it throughout the United States. We see it throughout our state. We're spending this money in Central America to reduce the pressure on our southern border, which is costing us billions of dollars, creating enormous amount of disruption and division. I am here as your leader, whether it's ideally a president, but senators are doing this all the time in their states, trying to explain why it is that we need to spend money over here or in this.
Hold on. I want to touch on that, because here's the thing, and Laura's point brings this up. If you are the average taxpayer, and we are already right now sending money to these countries through foreign aid programs, what we're seeing. Excuse me, I wish we had a cough button. By the way, Rob, we might want to do a cough button in the future. Thanks. The point I was making is, right now, if you're the average taxpayer, you see money going to these countries in Central America and Latin America, and we still, this month, are seeing the highest number of migration captures and interactions that we've seen in 10 years.
Can it be worse?
So I guess it could.
Can it be worse?
But if you are the taxpayer, if we're sending money down there to help stem this or help create programs that make these migrants want to stay there, Laura Chavez, it seems like to me that if on the average taxpayer, based on, you know, the numbers that are coming out of DHS and the words coming out of the White House, they actually might have a point there, saying, wait a minute, why are we sending them money if they're still going to come up here in record numbers? Don't send them money. We're still going to have the record numbers.
Yes, by that logic, absolutely. Yeah, why throw money at a problem at all?
Right.
But if that's
that
the case,
money could,
like,
go to my school and help it.
Hey, guys, don't worry. We can stop throwing money at the opioid crisis. We can stop throwing money at, you know, any sort of health issues we've got coming up. There are so many problems. Like, the solution is not to stop throwing money at it. What you do is Alan and Ken have a really great point. Like, education is really a big thing with this. This also isn't like the family in West Virginia whose taxes are probably going up to help try and send money over there or donating money. You're not going to see that in the tomorrow. It's not going to help put food on your table. No. But generationally, this is also a problem that people need to start looking at. We need to fix an immigration process in general. Like, yes, it's one thing to say anyone can come to the U.S. and seek asylum and be welcomed with open arms, but everybody knows that's not the actual case. It's a much larger process than that. But this process is so, it could be so great, it could be so wonderful having that money to just educate and say, hey, you know what, if we do this the right way, maybe the very low percentage of illegal immigrant crime will be quelled. Maybe if we figure out a better way to process them into the U.S., maybe if we figure out a better way to help the infrastructure in places like El Salvador or Ecuador or Mexico or any other country that happens to be one of the countries that people are trying to run to. Maybe if we work with them about different criminal justice opportunities or even just different vocational programs that could be introduced to the space to help try and keep drugs being the, like, most lucrative job. If you go with that route, then you can see that it's not just a situation where, yeah, right now we have people pouring into the border, but maybe we should actually look at this as a generational thing. We're creating a better world for our kids. It might be a problem for us today, but it's not going to be a problem for us in 12 years, 20 years, 50 years, whatever.
Alan.
I think we all acknowledge and agree, and we've said this many times, that there are a lot of people, a lot of voters, who are not very well informed. They're caught up in their own lives, trying to make things happen locally and keep food on the table, keep job, worry about health care. They're not that interested in what's going on outside their county, maybe outside their state, outside their region, and certainly outside the country. What we don't need in informing that group is leaders who take advantage of ignorance, exacerbate it, play with it, tell lies that feed biases that we know exist. So instead of informing people that there is a reason that's in America's interest that we spend as much as we do in foreign assistance, in particularly in a place like Central America, to try to stem the tide here, in other countries the reasoning is different, which is worth trying, whether it breaks through or not. What we don't need is a leader who says, here's what we need to do. We got a bunch of lying, murdering, raping thieves coming across. We need to erect a wall, and then we'll be safe. That's what we don't need.
Right. All right, we're going to take a break. We're going to keep this conversation going. When we come back, we're going to continue talking about this subject, the crisis on the southern border, and the really, really dumb idea that the president came up with. Hey, I got an idea. Let's close the doors. This is Backroom Politics. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
Disgusted, I found him out, had a showdown. When I think of him, how much I love him, I get a desperate notion. That's the way I feel today. My heart is aching because he's making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel today. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in, he packed and went away. What good is living? I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today. That's the way I feel today. My heart is aching because he's making a plaything of my devotion. That's the way I feel today. Without any reason or a word to say, that man turned his keys in and he packed and went away. What good is living? I'll soon be giving my body up to the ocean. That's the way I feel today. I said, that's the way I feel today. Thank you.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Backroom Politics with moderator Justin Russell.
And we're back in Studio A, the foam-encrusted nerve center of Backroom Politics, the best political talk show you've never heard of. I'm your host, moderator Justin Russell. In studio with me, Alan Moore, Admiral Ken, Laura Chavez will be back in a second, and inside the glass booth is Rob the Engineer. We're going to continue our discussion about the so-called crisis on the southern border, but I do want to take up, Admiral Ken, right before the break, you wanted to make a comment regarding all this aid and everything.
Well, I think the thing is that we are not dealing with the fact that there are just a lot of people. I'd say almost 30% of the electorate that chooses to be polled that think that we are in a true national security emergency. And this goes to what Alan was talking about. We have the problem that there are people that I know personally and professionally that think that there are terrorists that are trying to sneak across the border and hordes of them, and that if we don't erect a wall immediately, that we're going to all be killed in our sleep. And I'm quoting someone who said that to me just last week. And I guess, you know, the thing that I have the biggest issue with is that rather than focus on doing the education piece more, a lot of the media seems to be focused in on trying to combat the rhetoric with words rather than with true facts about what's really going on down there, and overwhelm that message, overwhelm that negative message. Because quite frankly, if we're waiting for that leadership to suddenly show up here in Washington, D.C. at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, we're fooling ourselves. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. Laura Chavez? You agree?
On waiting for the leadership at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's not going to show up. That's not what this administration's focus is. And I think it's more than interesting that every time an election's popping up or any time that there's some major crisis in the White House, somehow a caravan shows up on the southern border or one is headed right towards us. It's the favorite, you know, like drop back and punt line that the administration has, you know. When in doubt, make up a caravan. And there very well might, there have been caravans, yes. But keep in mind, a lot of those caravans are made up of women and children because it's not a safe journey. There's safety in numbers. At that point in time, you're looking at like, yeah, there's a caravan of women and children who are running from something else. You don't go into the water unless the land's not safe.
But we're also talking about a president that has also talked about this caravan, the migration coming up of women in duct tape in the back of vans and abortions happening in mid transit, all kinds of ludicrous statements coming out of the White House, creating fear inside the general American electorate. Alan Moore, is this a real situation that needs to be dealt with, or is it made up by a president that, as Laura said, has to punt when things get difficult? It's the easy fallback.
It is most definitely a situation that has to be dealt with. Our system on the border is overwhelmed. One day last week, 4,000 people. One day, 4,000 people were apprehended. That's a rate of 120,000 a month. I mean, we're back up at some really high numbers that we can't manage, and we've got a couple of issues. We can't keep kids longer than a couple of weeks. So if kids are with their little kids with their parents, then we're forced to release them. That's not any kind of an answer. Unaccompanied minors If they're from Mexico or Canada, and that's not a big problem with Canada, but legally, we can send those unaccompanied minors back. Legally, we don't have the authority to send them back to their home countries if it's not in not Mexico or Canada. Those are issues around which fair-minded, good-spirited politicians could conceivably come together and say, wow, maybe we need to let families be held longer before we just simply release them into the population and then a good number of them never show up again. Maybe we have to reflect on whether there's something to do with unaccompanied minors. I don't have the answer. But it's the kind of thing that saying the president is crazy, horrible, and wrong, therefore anything he proposes we're going to object to, and that feeds him saying the Democrats simply want open borders. There are no Democrats I know who want open borders. Everybody thinks that it is the important, responsible thing we must do, which is have some control over our borders, protect them. The question is what level of humanity and what level of truth we're going to require of the people who are trying to make these decisions. Right now, we've got a president who makes stuff up, feeds fear among people, and Democrats who are focused on the president's exaggerated words.
Instead of fixing the problem.
Instead of fixing the problem around which probably you could find, certainly a solid majority to do some things, but the tribes have separated. The president's the leader. This is an international issue. We look to him first. When he fails, which he continues to do, then the question is, who next? Can the Congress find a way to come together to work together?
Oh, come on! The president's already given us a great idea. We'll just close the doors. The president literally, as late as this morning, continues to rally around the threat of closing down the southern border, which. Again, you thought we couldn't get any more crazy, Alan. This is just stupidity on a major level. Lord Chavez, you would think that with everybody from Larry Kudlow to Kevin Hassett to every economist in America with half a brain that's telling him this could be an economic disaster for the U.S. economy, he still wants to lock the doors.
Absolutely. It plays really well to his base. And those are the people he needs to care about. I mean, in all honesty, like, he knows he's not 2020. Well, yes, in all honesty, like, as much as it pains me to say, he's probably going to be reelected. But he knows that he's going to have a fight. So he knows that the one thing that he really has to do is shore up that base. And he needs to keep them with him the whole time. And for all intents and purposes, this was a pretty good week for him. Like, he was... What was it? No collusion, but total exoneration.
Right.
I don't remember what it was, what he was claiming. It depends who you're reading.
Right.
But like all of those things. And now his base has this re-energized breath of fresh air. You know, there was no collusion. He's the best president. He's feeling good. He can make these kinds of strides. He can make these kinds of statements because right now he knows he's got, what is he averaging? I think 41% right now.
But they don't understand the people.
But that doesn't matter.
No, but the people that we're talking about, when these voters are sitting there going, close it down, shut down the southern border, they don't. Is it that they don't understand or they don't care that it's going to directly affect their jobs, their ability to get income, their ability to pay their mortgage, their ability to put food on the table that's cost effective?
The less you know about something, the simpler it must be.
Well, elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, they don't understand it, but Mexico is our third largest trading partner. You look at things as simple as auto parts, and Alan, feel free to fill in the gaps here. We build a part here. We send it over to Mexico. To get something else done. Then we send it back over here to get something else done. Then we send it back to Mexico, and then we send it back over here again for a final sale and assembly or installation of the car. If you shut down the border, that stops. That stops. And what your baseline Trump supporter doesn't understand is that we are no longer living in a world of the 1950s where we are the center of the universe and everybody's going to come begging to us for something. It doesn't work that way anymore. And no one in the administration is basically offering a counter argument or basically saying, hey, why this is a good idea beyond the fact that just shut it down. We'll just shut it down.
As a really funny side note, or as what I consider a really funny side note, I was reading in some journal that if the border is closed, in 3 weeks, the United States will pretty much be out of avocados. Which
what are we going to put on toast?
At which point, everyone was like, well, he just lost everyone under the age of 35.
What are we going to do? So, Alan Moore.
Chipotle's,
turkey burgers, everybody.
Actually, I'm glad she mentioned avocados because I last night on ABC and NBC both, I didn't watch CBS, they both mentioned avocados. And the notion was
3 weeks.
About three weeks. And I thought to myself, okay, that's illustrative on the one hand. On the other hand, and Laura makes the point about people of an age. I love avocados. I buy them. We eat them a lot.
Do you eat avocado toast?
Not on toast. No, most of you should.
Oh, yeah, rock solid.
Sometimes.
#millennial.
I'm learning.
Welcome.
Just about every night, avocado on a salad.
Yep.
Try a BLT with avocado sometime, and you'll never go back to the old kind.
I'm worried about my Philadelphia roll.
That's why Alan's hair is so shiny.
It is.
But hear me out here. How many Trump voters eat avocados constantly? He doesn't have that many young voters, and the center of the country. Well,
yep.
But Laura says anybody under 35, and I love my avocados. But I'm thinking, I don't think avocados sell this issue as well as other things
in like Omaha, Nebraska.
Well, exactly. As well as Ken's point, which is there's all this cross border traffic that leads directly to U.S. jobs, and in manufacturing jobs in America, almost every manufacturer you'll find in America has got some imported content in whatever.
But let's go back to this because Alan Moore is the former Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade. The industry that'll probably get – one of the industries that'll get hit hardest other than the avocado industry, 3 weeks, sweet mother of all that's holy, is the automotive industry. I don't think anybody realizes you shut down the border, you shut down cross-pollination of auto manufacturing that's going to put people out of jobs.
Oh, and that was Ken's exact point, that stuff moves back and forth. The auto workers are the ones that put Trump into office. Well, there's no one group that put Trump into office. You can find a half a dozen states and say what made the difference there. There were a lot of out of work former auto workers, and they're still out of work. who pivoted. It might have made the difference, but so were farmers affected. So were people who work in the retail business. We're talking here about groceries, and we're talking about avocados because I think somebody came up with a number. You'll be out of avocados in about 3 weeks. About half of America's imported fruit comes from Mexico. So maybe you don't eat avocados, but maybe you like apples. Maybe you like bananas. Maybe you like
you look at the whole I guess Trumpism thing about the border and the animus that he projected about the border from even when he announced his presidential campaign. What that does is it speaks to the ignorance that exists in the country about what goes on at our border. What happens with not just fruit and vegetables and auto parts? We talk about labor. So Americans are not coming across the border Americans are not going to the southern part of the U.S. to basically pick America's fruits and vegetables. They're not doing that. These are jobs that Americans have basically given up, and will not do. And so when you start talking about shutting down the border or building a wall or, you know, trying to keep those you know, the brown herd to the south, right, or whatever, you stop. You got to stop and get to think about the second and third order effects. Right. And if you talk to most Trump people, they're not really worried about that. They don't want to think about that because, again, it begs a level of advanced thought that they don't want to worry about or they don't want to do.
I've said this for the better part of about a decade. Anybody who says, oh, my God, the migrants are coming in, they're going to take our jobs. They're not going to take our jobs. You know what they're going to do is they're going to keep food items that you count on a daily basis at a price that is acceptable and that you're used to. You start taking away that workforce, Americans are going to sit there, well, they're taking our jobs. Okay, fine. Then you go into the fields and you do the migrant work.
Absolutely.
You go do hardcore construction in Orlando, Florida in the summertime. You go pick strawberries. Go pick citrus. Go pick apples in Washington State. Go harvest pecans in Georgia. You do that work and you put Americans in those jobs. They won't do those jobs for a price point that's going to, you're going to be paying $30 for a bushel of strawberries or $50 for a bag of oranges. That is what nobody understands. And that seems to be lost in translation somehow, Alan Moore.
Well, there are people who talk about that. I mean, the people who are promoting a $15 an hour minimum wage, for example, are confronted with this all the time. And they say, you're going to take the price of a big, you're going to double the price of a Big Mac. And their answer will be, well, that's what it should cost then. And people will have more money and they can spend more for a Big Mac. But
our economy can't handle that.
Well, not overnight. But I'm just saying that the response that people have is, or hey, why should we be subsidizing our food by taking advantage, by exploiting poor people in a third world country? It's a discussion worthy of serious back and forth. There's no simple minded, easy answer. But the fact of the matter is, products, particularly agricultural products that can be grown in greenhouses almost anywhere that are still labor intensive, tend to move where labor is cheaper. If you go to a Costco, you'll find stuff that comes all the way from China because it makes sense. Pine nuts is a good example. They're really expensive, right? The pine nuts at Costco come from China.
Right.
They don't come from the U.S. They don't come from Mexico. They come all the way from China.
But it's somebody that lived in Florida, that's somebody that had interaction with, let's say, the Florida citrus trade. You know, the biggest complaint that Florida citrus growers had is they can't be competitive with places like Brazil. They can't be competitive with places like the Philippines. You know, there are so many different markets that have cheaper labor, and they're still complaining, even though that they have migrant labor available to them to still be competitive in an American marketplace. I mean, Lord Jarvis, even in the urban sectors, nobody's going to pay $190 a night for a Motel 6 in Peoria, Illinois, because that's what the labor market's going to do. Nobody wants to do housekeeping.
No, and that, to your point, there are a lot of, for lack of a better term, kind of grunt jobs that a lot of Americans don't want to do. Nobody really wants to do them. No one aspires to say like, oh, I hope when I'm an adult I get to work 16-hour days while I'm sweating, wearing long sleeves in a field somewhere. But what they are doing, all these migrants that are coming over are saying, I aspire to more. I aspire to more for my kids. And that's kind of the broad... That's one of the things that a lot of people are missing when it comes to the immigration, the mass immigration that is coming this way. There was actually a study not too long ago that businesses that are owned by immigrants, first generation immigrants, not like, you know, people straight off the boat ideally, but their businesses produced over like the course of 20 years, 46% more than businesses that were owned by people who had their businesses passed down to them. It was genuinely just a drive to get a better life, which is something that is the reason, that is one of the sole reasons that a lot of these people are coming to the U.S.
Alan Moore.
And to build on that point, that success of immigrants also feeds resentment by Americans who never had the drive, never had the desperate need, and assume that those Vietnamese restaurateurs, nail salon owners, barbers, food store operators, and so on, somehow got a special deal, a special advantage. Nope. They were desperate. They fled. They were fearful. They saw a land of opportunity, and they worked their rear ends off. And they tend to trigger resentment rather than admiration. And that's again a challenge for politicians, but a challenge that smart politicians will rise to. And there are plenty in this country and plenty in Washington who do. They represent some of these people. They go into those communities. They thank them for their work, for their contribution, for their inspiration. But putting a positive light on it.
Is this a matter of... I'm trying to find the right word for it, Admiral Ken. It almost seems that what Alan just described is a sense of ignorant entitlement versus dealing with the reality of true migration in the United States, particularly on the southern border.
So, quick story. When I had one of my kids grew up in Texas, and they went to very good schools. And one of them says, you know, Dad, I want to go to college on the East Coast. And I said, honey, you can go anywhere you want. You know, all you got to do is get a scholarship and we'll be good to go. And my kid blew my mind and said, well, only Asian kids get in scholarships, Dad. And I basically chastised them for saying one of the most stupidly racist things I've ever heard in my entire life. So there's a to answer your question directly, yeah, there's a level of stupid ignorant entitlement that's at play, and it's aided greatly by a president who wants to harken back to things like they were in the good old days. One of the most entertaining moments I've seen on TV lately was Don Lemon and Anderson Cooper, when their shows are transitioning, singing the theme from All in the Family, because the president had made some comment about the fact that airplanes are too complicated to fly now.
Right.
So again, so I think, you know, I think that there's a hearkening, you know, back to wanting to get back to good old days, because face it, doing well in America is still possible. This is still the land of opportunity, but you know, but everybody around this table knows that the secret to success,
right,
you got to work your ass off,
Laura Chavez,
every day.
Laura Chavez, how devastating is shutting down the border for our economy?
Oh, it's massive. It's going to cripple. Just look at the border communities, like straight border communities. Don't even think of anything.
Brownsville, El Paso,
San Antonio, like
Tucson,
places like that.
Phoenix.
You know, don't even San Diego. Don't even think 50 miles north of the border. Just those communities alone. I think I saw a stat that was like there are 500,000 people that legally cross the border every day to work. If you shut that down, 500,000 jobs will be left undone just along the border. 500,000 people will be missing a paycheck. 500,000 things will be just left for naught that day. And that will go on day after day after day, crippling the economy in not only those communities, but it'll have a trickle-down effect through the entire country. So it would be devastating.
Right. Alan Moore, last word.
Yeah, I've seen numbers in the range of $1.5 billion per day of cross-border trade between us and the southern border. That's about $500 billion a year. Would all of that stop? No. It would stop momentarily, and then some of it would be on airplanes, and some of it would be on ships, and it would be highly, horrendously disruptive. I think the numbers of job folks back and forth is even larger than the 500,000 that Laura talks about. Some of that eventually would sort itself out, but there would be massive disruption, massive financial losses. They're just really hard to quantify, for nothing, for no useful purpose, for the purpose of a president,
of satisfying a base voter block.
A president saying, wanting to show some level of toughness and deciding, I can do this, I'm going to do this. Everybody around me in my White House, not to mention in the Republican Party, says, don't do it, don't do it. I can do it. I'm the president. I like doing things on my own authority.
All right. We're going to let that be the last word. On behalf of Alan Moore, Admiral Ken, Laura Chavez, so good to have you in studio. Do this more. You're going to be here next week?
Ask the people who hire me. I don't know. Ask some of my clients.
Oh, good. Now you just made it. This is an all-volunteer force. Thanks. Oscar switching out seats for Rob the Engineer behind the glass. Thank you for keeping us honest. I'm your host and moderator, Justin Russell. We will be back with the best political talk show you've never heard of, live to us, Podcast Village, Studio A in Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. You can follow us on Twitter at Backroom Politic, where you can listen to us live every Tuesday from 4 to 6. You can also download us as a podcast on your favorite podcasting service, whether iTunes, Google Podcasts, even Spotify. Yeah, we're kind of a big deal now. Have a great week, America. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.